Welcome to Open Spaces. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. The first ever Sportsperson Conservation Forum tackled some of the biggest issues in the field.
Folks want to have lots of deer, and they also want to have lots of elk. And the science indicates that you may not be able to have both.
A Wyoming woman whose son's murder was a hate crime has won the Presidential Medal of Freedom for her advocacy work.
The state of Wyoming, right after Matt was killed, had the opportunity to become a leader in this field and ran away.
A handful of recent federal rule changes target coal. And while the industry has been declining for a while now, Wyoming still heavily relies on it.
We rely on coal in this state to the tune of about over $600 million annually.
Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
You already listen to public radio, but what if public radio could listen back? It does on the NPR One app. Hear local, national, and international news plus podcasts based on what you like. The more you listen, the more it gets to know you. Download NPR One at your app store.
Coming up on Wyoming Sounds, it's New Music Wednesday with me, Melanie Nielsen. Join me for new music from Cowboy Ross Cooper, The Fratellis in Babe Rainbow, Fruit Bats, Court Lund, and this one from Galen McKinney from the McKinney Zone. Tune in 9 to noon for Wyoming Sounds on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. Earlier this week, Governor Gordon brought together wildlife experts and the public for the first Sportsperson Conservation Forum. It took place in Du Bois and covered topics like mule deer management and wildlife crossings. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman spoke with Wyoming Game and Fish Director Brian Nesvik about his takeaways from the event.
So, Brian, one of the forum's big goals was to try to bring people together to talk and connect with each other. What was the overall tone of the event? Any moments of tension or big breakthroughs?
The intent here was just to bring folks together and highlight some of the biggest both successes and challenges facing wildlife and wildlife habitat across our state, and then to encourage folks to find their way to become involved and to have influence over helping to continue our successes and also deal with our challenges. You know, as far as any points of contention, I guess I wouldn't say there was anything that became just real palpable in the room, but there certainly was some contentious topics discussed, like planning and zoning at the local and county level, which is always a contentious topic. You know, there's certainly some discussions around fair chase, which oftentimes can be different based on, you know, an individual's perspective on what fair chase is. But overall, the tone was just very positive, and I was very happy with the event. I think we certainly achieved our objectives, and it exceeded my expectations.
And Brian, just for listeners who maybe don't know, could you give a one-sentence blurb about what fair chase is?
I gotta think about that. What most sportsmen would define as fair chase as those practices and behaviors that give the animal that's being hunted a fair opportunity to escape.
Thanks for that definition. One of the panels focused on declining mule deer populations throughout the state, which is obviously an issue that's gotten a lot of attention in the last couple of years. Were there any big insights about how to address that issue?
That's a really good question. This whole discussion around declines in mule deer has been something that I know has been on not only sportsmen's minds, but also just ranchers and wildlife enthusiasts. A common theme around the mule deer issue was that there are a significant number of different threats that all can have either small or moderate impacts on mule deer. And it's almost like, you know, this death by a thousand cuts kind of an analogy, where when you look at things like wildlife disease, like chronic wasting disease, and then you look at continued human presence and human dominated landscapes with urban sprawl and more subdivisions and more development in many different ways, whether it be roads or fences or energy development. The concerns with competition with other species like elk, when we have places in the state where elk populations are growing beyond what they've been in the past. There's a lot going on out there that is not necessarily good for mule deer. As far as the, you know, what can we do? There's been interest in doing something here for a long time, and a lot of those successes were highlighted, you know, working on large scale habitat projects for mule deer, looking at highway crossings where we know we have mortality, looking at ways to continue to evaluate and find ways to try to manage mule deer in a way that reduces the prevalence of CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Those were all some things that have been either demonstrated and need to continue, or ideas that need to be tried in the future. Like, for example, the changing up management techniques specific to chronic wasting disease.
Changing gears a little bit, I have to ask, did the Sublette County Wolf incident come up at all? And from your perspective, how is that influencing discourse about predator species management?
It did come up briefly when we were on the panel that addressed fair chase. And I think that the panelists that brought the issue up really framed the issue in a Wyoming way and reflected what I've heard from a lot of Wyoming folks. You know, bottom line is that, you know, I haven't heard from anybody that condoned or felt that those actions around that incident were right. But there's a real need to have thoughtful, deliberate dialogue and discussion around if and how policy needs to be changed to address, you know, the behaviors of one individual that obviously nobody finds as right or reasonable.
Makes sense that it came up. Definitely a hot issue. Any topics that weren't discussed at the forum that you wish had been talked about?
I really feel like we hit the mark on what was most important to talk about now. I mean, we only had roughly 5.5 hours when you took out a lunch break, but there certainly are a lot of other topics that could be discussed that are challenges in Wyoming that I suspect will be discussed for topics at future forums. I think that there was a lot of momentum yesterday from people who want to see this conducted on an annual basis, and I believe there's support to do that.
I'm talking with Brian Nesvik, the director of Wyoming Game and Fish. Brian, did the forum illuminate any topics where there's a discrepancy between what the public wants and what Game and Fish is up to?
There certainly was one that comes to mind fairly quickly here, and that's this whole discussion around elk outcompeting mule deer. And there is certainly some science that was presented from Dr. Kevin Monteith at the Hobbs School that indicates there very well may be some competition. And so the conundrum there is folks want to have lots of deer and they also want to have lots of elk. And the science indicates that you may not be able to have both. As we look forward and we as Game and Fish have discussions about what objectives should be for elk populations, especially in those places where we're concerned about deer and our deer populations are below those objectives, I think that's going to be a real interesting discussion with the public to see if Game and Fish can find the sweet spot.
Obviously, there's so much interest in these conversations. The 350 seats at the event were fully reserved. What would you want to say to any sports people or conservationists in Wyoming who weren't able to attend the event?
Yeah, well, for those folks that were not able to attend, we are going to be looking at providing a summary and any of the materials that were used during the forum by the panelists so that folks can get a flavor of what was discussed. And then, you know, we're going to get back together with the steering committee and look back at what did we learn as far as participation and do we need to look for a different way to do this so that more people can be engaged.
Anything else you'd like to add that we haven't touched on in this conversation?
When you looked at all the topics and all the presentations that the panelists provided, you know, there's always a lot of discussion around the science of wildlife management. And one thing that continues to be clear to me is that science has a broad meaning. There's obviously biological science that's important, but there's also social and political science that's all part of wildlife management in Wyoming. And I think that those topics and the way that people addressed them really brought that out.
That's a good note to end on. I've been talking with Brian Nesvik, the director of Wyoming Game and Fish, about the recent first ever Wyoming Sportsperson Conservation Forum. Brian, thanks for taking the time to talk today.
You bet, Hannah. Have a great day.
Judy Shepard's son, Matthew, was killed in Laramie more than 25 years ago in a hate crime. Now, Shepard, a longtime Wyomingite and advocate for LGBTQ rights, has received the highest civilian honor in the U.S. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements speaks to Shepard about the award and the work Wyoming still needs to do to prevent the kind of violence that led to her son's death.
So, Judy, how did you react when you got the news that you'd received the Presidential Medal of Freedom for your work?
Well, I got a call from the First Lady's office, and it was a surprise, as you can imagine. It was pretty overwhelming. Pretty sure I cried a few tears. Really hit home. The thing is, I never feel like I deserve it because I'm not really, this isn't a career I set out to do. And there's many, many who have. So it's, for me, it's sort of a mixed blessing, I guess. I greatly appreciate the president takes an interest in the work that we do. And in me, we've known each other a long time since Matt first was killed. President Biden was on the Senate Judiciary Committee in 99, and I testified before that committee. And that's when I first met him. So he is aware of us, and I appreciate his remembering, I guess.
What does it mean to you that you've received this award? I mean, it's the highest award possible for a citizen of the U.S. I mean, how does that land with you?
Well, it's a combination of humbling and honoring. I thought I was going to be really upset when they did the presentation. But when I saw the other people also being honored, it's like, oh, they're like A-listers. I'm cool. I'm good. We're all good here. It was a big moment.
It's been more than 25 years since Matthew, your son, was tortured and killed for being gay. I mean, what do you think about the current state of hate against LGBTQ people in Wyoming?
So hardly anybody lives here, right? So, and if you're different at all, you are immediately noticed. The violence per capita, I don't think is any higher in Wyoming, but it also hasn't changed. Wyoming still doesn't have a hate crime law. It's very discouraging that the state of Wyoming, right after Matt was killed, had the opportunity to become a leader in this field and ran away. It's very discouraging. But the level of hate nationwide, even worldwide, against the community is frightening and infuriating because we were on such a good path. We're back on the path, I think.
And there's another anniversary also, the 15-year anniversary of the legislation that passed Congress, right, in the wake of Matt's killing.
Kind of think it's probably not a coincidence that this is happening. Obama signed it into law in October of 2009. So this October will be 15 years since it was signed into law. Landmark case, first time positive steps were taken for the community rather than trying to take things away from them or, you know, deny them rights. So that was quite the experience. Actually, that was right on par with the honor, the award.
When you began your advocacy work, did you anticipate it resonating with so many Americans and Wyomingites?
I did not. We started a foundation in Matt's name 6 weeks after he passed because people had been sending us money and I didn't know what to do with it. So we started this nonprofit. I thought maybe we can help Matt's friends or his peers have a better life. We thought 2 years, 3 years max, people move on from one terrible thing to another. I had no idea it was going to last this long or that Matt's story would resonate with such a large worldwide audience. I guess it was just the timing and, you know, sir, I can't explain it, but we didn't think it was going to last this long for sure.
The grieving process, I know, like it can take decades before, you know, things become clear or change for folks. And I guess I wanted to ask, like, how you've been dealing with just what happened after so many years.
There's no such thing as closure or moving on or, you know, thinking about it. It's always in your mind. Even when we talk about Matt, it's hard to remember certain things. I try not to visualize things when I'm talking about it. It's just as raw now as it was then. Rose Kennedy has this great quote about building your life around the scar tissue of an incident. She had many of those incidents. And I think that's what we've done. Your life is different, but the pain really, it doesn't change. Your life is just different now.
I don't know if you've heard about the latest with the legislature trying to slash the budget of the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the university. Yes. And I guess part of that includes the Matthew Shepard Symposium. I mean, there's sort of this renewed push to eliminate those types of programs. What do you think about that?
Oh, I'm really unhappy about it. But to tell you the truth, I'm not surprised based on who is in the legislature now. We have elected folks who are not even true libertarians or Republicans. I don't know what they are. They're people who want chaos. I'm not surprised. I am heartbroken that this is happening. All the things that make us better people to learn about other people might be denied now to students. And I think it's a disaster and heartbreaking all around.
And you're about to head out with the State Department. Where are you going, Judy?
Going to Australia, Singapore, Fiji, and New Zealand.
And is that part of just what happens when you receive that award? Or is it separate?
It is separate. We started doing State Department trips in the Obama administration. We did several then, and then I'm getting a little long in the tooth to be doing them, quite frankly. But they're really fun, and we learn a lot. And it is heartbreaking, but also heartwarming that those folks know Matt's story.
Are you going to be speaking at different events when you're out there?
Yeah, each embassy organizes community meetings. There's a couple of them are showing the documentary about Matt. Matt Shepard is a friend of mine. We will be meeting with the embassy staff, LGBT organizations in those countries. In Singapore, it's not illegal anymore, but it's also not 100% welcome. Fiji is very much a missionaryized place to be. So it's very right-wing, conservative Christian. New Zealand and Australia both are ahead of us in these rights. So I'm interested in learning from them. But they're also not, they're not 100% there either yet. So it's a learning, it's an educational trip on both sides.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Judy.
Thanks. Bye, Chris.
Judy Shepard is the founder of the Matthew Shepard Foundation, an LGBTQ nonprofit organization headquartered in Casper.
A former Wyoming state archaeologist has written a book about his life in the state. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Hearing one story over and over again gets pretty old pretty fast. On Morning Edition, you'll hear all kinds of stories, from the big news to things that are just fun. Listen to Morning Edition every weekday from NPR News.
From 5 until 9 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Check out the Wyoming Public Radio Politics Quiz. Are you up to date on the latest state government news? If so, test that knowledge out. In this week's quiz, a homeless shelter in Cheyenne is trying to turn what former business into affordable housing units? Think you know the answer? Find out at wyomingpublicmedia.org and click the WPR Politics Quiz tab.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Former Wyoming state archaeologist and author Mark Miller has written a new book titled A Sometimes Paradise, Reflections of Life in a Wyoming Ranch Family. Wyoming Public Radio's Grady Kirkpatrick recently spoke with Miller about the book.
At what point in your life did you decide you wanted to write this book?
Oh, I think probably in the early 2000s. I'd been away from the ranch for several years and living in Laramie and had a little time on my hands, and I was worried I'd start forgetting the stories. So I said,
mm-hmm. What or who was the main inspiration behind writing the book?
When I started the book, I did it as kind of a dedication in my mind to my grandfather, Kirk Miller, because of the circumstances we experienced when I was growing up out there. I felt I owed him a favor.
Your family has quite a rich history in Carbon County. Who first acquired the ranch?
Well, that would be Isaac C. Miller, my great-grandfather, went into partnership with Joel Hurt in 1881. and Hurt had a homestead out there. He'd been a game getter for when the Union Pacific Railroad went through and started running sheep out there. And they started a partnership in 1881, and the Miller Steak Company grew from that.
Describe the landscape on the ranch.
Well, it's the Western Hanna Basin. Those of you that are familiar with Carbon County, it borders on the north by the Seminole Mountains, on the east by the North Platte River and Seminole Reservoir, which also borders the southern part of the ranch where it makes a bend. And then the western margin of the ranch is the Haystack Mountains, which form the east rim of the Great Divide Basin, where the Continental Divide splits around the Great Divide Basin.
There are some memorable and humorous descriptions and lines in the book. One was when you referenced growing up on the ranch. You said, most of my friends were the four-legged kind. You were around a lot of animals.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We had every animal you could think of. I think I mentioned most of them in there, but bar none, horses were my favorite. I think they were my brother's favorite. I know they were my great-grandfather's favorite because he wrote that. And it's a connection, a man and a horse. It's just hard to beat anywhere else.
Yeah, one of the chapters specifically devoted to horses. And I don't think I've ever read a better description of the relationship between humans and horses. You reference many of the horses' names and their temperaments. Tell us briefly maybe about one of your favorite horses.
Oh, bar none, my favorite horse was Tabasco, who I was young enough to really think I knew how to ride. I'm going to give my brother credit here because he was a better rider than I was, but I worked hard at it. And Tabasco taught me a lot about riding in ways that are harder to remember.
Oh, yeah, I'll bet. There's also a chapter devoted to your grandfather, Kirk. Describe the influence and lessons learned from your grandfather.
When we were grandkids, there were five of us, my brother and myself and three cousins. And we were around Kirk all the time. He was still manager of the ranch, but he was old enough to where Dad was doing most of the work. So we'd hang out with Kirk all the time. And
he was like a friend.
Yeah, he was like a sixth member of the club. And so he was the first adult on the ranch that really impressed upon me aspects of the country, aspects of the culture, and aspects of the fabric of family.
There's a strong connection to family and friends throughout the book, as well as a connection to the land and animals that paints a vivid picture of what it was like to work on a Wyoming ranch in the mid-20th century. A lot of people lament the passing of this way of life. How do you think these strong connections to people and places in the West can continue well into the 21st century?
To me, the big thing was that we had an enduring family ranch when we were managing it. And in terms of the management, we didn't own controlling interest, but the family managed it for the century. And I think whatever Wyoming can do to preserve that aspect of ranching, I think far too many of them are being purchased by out-of-state owners, companies that buy ranches for their corporate recreational opportunities. But, you know, the family ranch is, it's struggling. And I think it's an important part of Wyoming culture that deserves to be protected.
To what extent did growing up on the ranch lead you in a couple of different positions? You worked with the Wyoming Stock Growers Association and then became the Wyoming State Archaeologist for three decades. And how did growing up on the ranch kind of lead you in those directions?
I grew up on a ranch, and when I was old enough to go to college, I didn't know what to major in. And my dad advised me against majoring in agriculture because he knew the fragile nature of our family control over the management of Miller Steak Company. So he took me to an archaeological dig on the ranch that was happening at that time, and he introduced me to George Frison. And when I met George there, and George talked about the site he was working on, explained it to me, I just hooked. And I went back to the university next semester, declared my major in anthropology and archaeology, and worked with him the rest of his life, and ended up getting the state archaeologist job when he stepped down.
That's great. You also were co-chair of the public lands with the Wyoming Stock Growers Association at pretty young age.
Yeah, we, in the early 80s, 1980-81, Rod and I were involved with the Carbon County Stock Growers Association, and we were fighting a grazing environmental impact statement that was using a computer forage model to figure out how much grass cows could eat on public lands in the West. And we found an error in the model. And it wasn't just us. I mean, the university was working on it. Mm-hmm. Everybody wanted, you know, the old adage, garbage in, garbage out. Well, we wanted to see if there was any garbage. And we found some. And they dropped that model. And it was not used to allocate forage because of some of the stuff everybody found. And I think that got the attention of some stock growers at the state level. And that's when I was invited to be vice chairman. And Rod got on the Game and Fish Committee there. Mm-hmm. And that all happened right the last year we were on the ranch.
Yeah.
And I moved on to archaeology after that.
One more question, Mark. Are the winters in Wyoming not as cold and windy as they used to be 40 or 50 years ago?
I've been in some pretty cold winters not too long ago, but out there when we were ranching, there were a couple winters, and 77 is one I remember that just was a killer. I mean, there was so much snow on the ground, we couldn't even find the county road. And Dad, to drive out the ranch, we were 20 miles out of town, and Dad would drive up on top of the ridges because they were blown open,
yeah,
and get out there. And when we got to our ranch, there's a county road that goes through the ranch, and the county had to try to keep that open. And they were not doing a great job because it was such a bad winter. But yeah, they had a long stretch of it cleaned out, and they got it down to the asphalt. And there were 10-foot tall walls of snow on either side of the highway. And there were 1,500 pronghorn on the highway between those walls. And Dad and I pulled in behind them, and they were going slow because they were sliding all over.
Yeah.
And we just followed them at like 5-10 miles an hour until they got on a hill they could get away from. And that's the toughest winter I remember being in. And, of course, Dad remembers the winter of 49.
Sometimes Paradise, Reflections on Life in a Wyoming Ranch Family from Sandra Jonas Publishing, a testament to the spirit of the West. Thank you very much, Mark Miller.
Mark Miller and his brother Rod will be at the Carbon County Museum in Rawlins June 1st at 7 p.m. for a book signing and to talk about their ranching experiences. Up next, our natural resources and energy reporter breaks down recent updates in the coal industry. This is Open Spaces.
This time on The Modern West, we find out all the crazy workarounds people have found for the lack of affordable housing in Jackson.
It's cold when you come back, and the issue then is like all your water freezes, and like trying to dry ski stuff or anything like that, it's a pain. But once the heaters are going, it gets cranking in here.
Chasing the Dragon. It's episode 4 of our series, High Altitude Tales. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Neuroscientist Wendy Suzuki basically lived at her lab.
I just felt really, really bad.
So she started working out, which improved more than just her muscles.
My focus was working better, and that made me say, what's going on here?
Wendy's discovery has kept her active ever since. New ideas to help you keep your resolutions. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. It's not news to anyone that coal has been declining for a while now. Production in Wyoming has almost halved since 2008. But that decline could steepen thanks to recent federal rules and proposals. Caitlin Tan covers energy and natural resources for Wyoming Public Radio and has been reporting on these recent developments. And she's here to put this in perspective for the Cowboy State, which is still the top coal producer in the nation. So for starters, what are these new federal rules and proposals?
Yeah, so the first round came in April from the Environmental Protection Agency, and it's pretty heavy duty. Analysts say this alone could push the coal industry toward extinction. And the main part of these rules that you guys need to probably know is that it requires all existing coal-fired power plants to cut or capture 90% of their emissions or convert to natural gas. And that's all got to happen in the next 8 years.
Right. I'm assuming this is related to addressing climate change. And I know that's been a big goal of President Biden's administration.
Yeah, totally. So the EPA earmarked these power plant rules as a way to help with Biden's goals. And that's because, you know, coal power plants are the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions, which are warming the planet. And just last year, we saw the hottest year on record.
Okay, and what's the second blow to coal?
Yeah, so there was a proposal that came from the Bureau of Land Management just this month. The BLM announced this proposal to end new federal coal leasing in the Powder River Basin, which we all know supplies more coal than anywhere else in the country. And again, so a little backstory here. This is part of the BLM's updated land use plan for that area. And originally, it didn't include anything about ending new leases. But then a court order told them to consider how coal leasing in the area affects climate change and health concerns. And now this is the result. So now, if the proposal goes through, existing mines will be allowed to keep on as usual. And the BLM estimates those resources will probably dry up in about 2041.
Okay, and what do these new rules and proposals actually mean for Wyoming? So for our coal plants and mines?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I should start by saying none of this is set in stone. There's likely a long road of legal challenges ahead. But, you know, it definitely sets the tone, right? Like, many agree that the federal government is shifting away from coal. So with this power plant rule, electric utility companies that own these plants, they're going to have to decide. Do they want to shut down completely, switch to natural gas, or retrofit with carbon capture technology, which in theory captures the climate warming emissions?
But they don't really have that much time to do that, isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, 8 years in this world is very short, especially when you think about carbon capture technology. It's still not proven on a commercial scale, and it's really expensive right now. Now, that's not to say that Wyoming hasn't made impressive strides, but it's a gamble to say that electric utilities will actually use this technology. And if they don't, that's where the problem lies for Wyoming's mines. Because we supply the majority of the coal to these plants all across the country. And if they don't need our coal, then, well, our mines are mostly out of work.
Okay, so that's the EPA power plant rules. What does the BLM proposal mean for Wyoming?
Well, it depends who you ask. Travis Detai with the Wyoming Mining Association, he says it'd be devastating, effectively ending the industry.
Basically putting our huge coal resources in the Powder River Basin off limits, and you know the impacts are amazing. And you know we rely on coal in this state, you know, to the tune of about over $600 million annually, and that is the money that, you know, builds our roads and funds our communities and our schools.
And in that way, Detai isn't wrong. You know, the industry employs about 5,000 people in Wyoming. And the tax structure here on coal is the glue for funding K-12 schools and is a major trust fund for the state. But on the other hand, some say coal's decline is nothing new and that shutting down new leases in the Powder River Basin is really just symbolic. Here's Shannon Anderson, an attorney representing a regional conservation group.
From, you know, the reality perspective, this decision does practically nothing. We've had, you know, what we call a market moratorium on Powder River Basin coal leases since June of 2012.
That's because 2012 was the last time BLM sold any new coal leases. But Anderson says this horrified response from the industry is a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction. She says the existing mines will still produce for another 17 years or so, and that this can allow time for Wyoming to figure out what things look like without coal.
Okay, can we take a step back, Caitlin? How were things looking before the announcements of these federal changes?
Not great. Coal hit its peak in Wyoming in 2008 and has for the most part declined ever since. In fact, demand for the state's coal went down 20% this year compared to last. And, you know, that's related to it being a mild winter and that, frankly, other sources of electricity were just cheaper. And I should also note that the main electric company in Wyoming has plans to retire all of their coal plants in the state by 2039. So, as you can imagine, the industry is panicking. You could really see that at the most recent Legislative Minerals Committee meeting. Travis Detai, who we heard from earlier, he basically pleaded to lawmakers for help. He asked for tax credits for mining equipment and a severance tax break. And honestly, Camila, what stood out to me was this moment of maybe mild frustration from Representative Cyrus Western of Sheridan and then Detai's frankness.
We just lowered the severance tax rate for mining. It's savings of about $50 million a year. What have the companies been doing with that $50 million?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Western, that's a great question. Trying to stay alive.
So ultimately, the lawmakers actually didn't give Detai anything. They think a different committee needs to take it up. But most of them, and this has been true for years now, still express the state needs to save coal. Senator Donald Burkhart of Rawlins gave us a peek into what would happen without it. The tiny town of Hanna in southeast Wyoming, well, it used to have 5 mines.
They have none now. And see what the town looks like. They used to have a medical clinic. They used to have 2 grocery stores.
And now Hanna has less than 700 people. And honestly, there really isn't an industry there.
That's what it looks like if we don't keep our coal resources up and running.
But again, many analysts say this is totally out of Wyoming's hands and that it's really just purely market demand. I actually spoke with Rob Godby earlier this year. He's an economics professor at UW who's been tracking coal super closely. And he says coal is getting outpriced by natural gas and now wind and solar, too. Godby says federal projections show it's all kind of coming to a tipping point.
This is the year where the inevitable happens, where coal gets surpassed by solar and wind.
Godby also sits on the Consensus Revenue Estimating Group for Wyoming, and they actually put together their 5-year forecast earlier this year.
Absent some new use for the coal that we have here, it will probably decline to a much lower level, you know, could go away entirely depending on, you know, how policy goes, but that would be several decades away. But we see it declining at a pretty significant rate over the next 5 years.
Okay, and how is Wyoming responding to all of this? You mentioned earlier a long road of legal challenges.
Yeah, you know, Wyoming is really hoping that these rules just won't be their reality. Randall Luthy, the governor's policy director, he spoke about why at that recent committee meeting.
Litigate, litigate, litigate. That is what we do. We don't hesitate to litigate.
Wyoming actually joined onto 2 lawsuits to sue the EPA over that power plant rule and will more than likely challenge the BLM's Powder River Basin proposal as well. And so that's all going to probably be tied up in court for a while. But in the meantime, as we all know, it's an election year and Wyoming leaders are hoping this could all look different if Donald Trump wins. But again, analysts say it's more of a market thing. Here's Rob Godby one more time talking about Trump's presidency.
Coal still declined faster than it had ever declined before. You know, the president maybe is the most powerful person in the world, but even the president can't stop markets. And the bottom line is markets are moving away from fossil fuels.
So I guess just to wrap this all up, it's undeniably a challenging time for the coal industry. I think that's something we all can agree on. And also it frankly shapes so much of Wyoming's economy. So if markets continue to move away from coal, if we see more federal policies kind of quickening that, the state's going to have to figure out what to do, you know, how to replace that revenue.
Well, Caitlin Tan, Wyoming's Public Radio's energy and natural resources reporter, thank you so much for updating us all on this pretty complicated topic, which is the state of coal in Wyoming.
Definitely. Thanks for having me.
Up next, we visit a prison where inmates train wild horses as part of their rehabilitation. This is Open Spaces.
Did you know that all 6 episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now? That's right. Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
The story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Recidivism rates in the U.S. are some of the highest in the world. And in Wyoming, 33% of inmates are back in prison within the first year. But studies show that animal therapy can help reduce that by teaching things like responsibility, nonviolence, and empathy. Wyoming has a special program, one of only 5 in the country, that teaches inmates how to tame wild horses. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards visits Wyoming's Honor Farm near Riverton.
In the spring sunshine, a guy in a red inmate shirt rides a big red horse named Scarlet around in a corral. Taylor Meese says his goal today is to get Scarlet to come to a complete halt, but he's having a little trouble. She's paying more attention to my microphone than to him.
You notice she's got like one ear kind of focused on you?
Travis Schutman, the agricultural manager at the Honor Farm, gives him some pointers.
Take a deep breath. Mr. Meese, just relax.
You're going to be fine. Just a little bit how they sense as well. Like he's a little nervous, she's a little nervous.
Yeah. Finally, Scarlet calms down. And away the two of them go. Not many wild horses get so lucky as Scarlet, though. That's because of the growing numbers of the animals on the landscape. Back in the 1970s, there was only about 17,000 wild horses in the West. Now, over 83,000. It's left very little grass on the range for them to eat. A couple years ago, the BLM removed over 4,000 from Wyoming's range. Many end up in long-term holding facilities in the Midwest or are purchased to sell for slaughter. Schutman says this program doesn't solve this enormous problem, but
the more skill sets that we give that horse, the more value he has in this world. That horse being feral, wild, untouchable, not rideable, doesn't have a lot of worth to a lot of people.
Schutman says the same goes for the men. Training them to work gives them value, too. That old-fashioned idea of breaking horses? Yeah, they don't do that here.
We don't break anything like it's a terrible term.
Instead, they use the philosophy of natural horsemanship to apply pressure and release. Same goes for the men. Many have never ridden a horse in their life. For instance, growing up in Gillette, one of inmate Taylor Meese's only experiences with horses was as a teenager.
His horse bit me on the face.
No.
Yes. It had big teeth. And he got a hold of me. But I was determined to not let that hold me back.
Meese knows what it's like to be held back. His mom died when he was 16, and he started getting in trouble. Then he was accused of a crime he alleges that he didn't commit. When he got sentenced to 8 to 13 years, he says he experienced a mental breakdown.
It was horrible. It was a concrete box. I had for sure lost my mind twice in county jail.
But then they sent him to the Honor Farm. His first horse was a Palomino.
So I was feeling like a rock star. And then they go to clean up his feet and I don't know what happens in the shoe pen, like he gets a hoof stuck in one of these parts of the, and he ends up breaking his foot. His foot, the hoof part comes off and it's pretty horrible. And unfortunately they had to put that horse down. And so that was a big tragedy to me.
Meese's anxiety came flooding back. He had to go back on anti-anxiety medication. But then a little buckskin mare named Belle came along.
and I would work it every day, I really started seeing results with it. Like, consistency is a big deal when you're training horses. Showing up to work one day and half a day the next and not showing up that day, like, you'll see it directly in your horse's behavior. And I seen that 100% with that horse.
Is that right?
And then I was like, okay, I gotta double down. Like, this horse's success depends on me now.
The time came to sell Belle at the Honor Farm's public auction. A doctor bought her for $125, money that went straight back into the prison's budget. He says experiences like this improved his mental health.
Horse hugs are the best hugs in the world because they're huge and they'll wrap their head around you and stuff like that. And so, I mean, if you can't, that doesn't calm me down like eternally, like, I don't know what will. So absolutely has helped my anxiety. Yeah.
Mee says a rancher he knows in Gillette has offered him a job cowboying when he gets out. And he's already got his eye on a horse he wants to adopt, a spirited Spanish buckskin named Bruja.
You know, wild horses are special because they're on the prairie, just the tough life that they have out there, but they become strong over generations and generations of living out there.
Truth is, these Wyoming men have also led generations of tough lives. At the Honor Farm, the message is loud and clear. As a community, we can't give up on them, wild horses or men, because maybe someday someone will give them a good home. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
You can hear a longer version of this story on the Modern West podcast. It comes out on Wednesday, May 29th. Find it on their podcast at wyomingpublicmedia.org. A couple of summers ago, the nonprofit StoryCorps hosted an oral history project here in Wyoming, in which veterans and their families recorded honest and personal stories about their military experience. We're grateful to share those conversations now with our listeners. Today, we hear from 61-year-old Diane Berner and her mother, Demi, as they recount fond memories of Diane's grandmother, who joined the Navy in World War I, and the importance of passing on family history.
We have often talked about your mother's service to our country when she was in the Navy. I would love it if you could tell in your words a little bit about Nana and how she came to join the service.
My mother went into the Navy at 16 years old, but the reason she did that, she wanted to leave the home. The reason I think that my mother went into the Navy was because her father was a real taskmaster, and even to the boys in the family. And so she felt like she wanted to go out on her own.
Ah, so now we know where our strong womanhood comes from. My goodness.
Oh, yeah. She went to the recruiter, and she went over and talked to the lady, and then the lady said, "How old are you?" And she said, 16. And she talked some more, and later on the lady said, you have to be 18 to get into the Navy. How old are you?" After she already told her she was 16. And so she said, okay, that was all right.
So Nana said she was 18 when she was 16.
Yeah.
So she could join the Navy.
Uh-huh.
Oh my goodness.
Can you imagine? Yes. Yeah. Wow. It was also interesting because there weren't very many women in those days in the Navy at all. Mm-hmm. And so she was, all her life, she was very happy. The big navy blue coat that she had, it was something she was proud of, you know, that she did get in.
She did it. She bucked the system, I guess, and that's kind of having been to Wyoming and graduated from the university here, I mean, that's kind of what we're all about, bucking the system. You came out to Wyoming, and then Nana and Papu came out here later with you.
And Nana and Papu, I mean, grandparents, grandmother.
In Greek?
Greek, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they ended up in Douglas, even. Yeah, up in Douglas,
yeah, they
Wyoming.
Came. Yeah, they mm-hmm. did. Yeah. And mother died, and she was 95. Let me say this. I wish that we will be able to find my mother being in the waves, because I want to know if there are people that we could still get together with, you know. And all I need to do is keep working on it, because there's hardly anything about the women that were in the First World War.
Having these memories and
yeah. uh-huh.
traditions
yeah.
and keeping them going for our
yeah.
children.
Uh-huh.
That's so important.
Yeah. And I think we don't pay attention as much, but I think it's something we need to really take care of for our families.
Nana's name was Esther Adelaine Gailey, G-A-I-L-E-Y. She was just always there for me. Always looked out for me, and I was not easy. Well, and you said your parents always looked out for your welfare.
Yeah.
And I just want to say thank you for always looking
oh.
out for my welfare.
Well,
and my babies.
Don't cry.
Sorry, it's what I do. Thank you, Mom.
Yeah, thank you, dear.
That was Diane Berner interviewing her mother, Demi, for our Veterans StoryCorps project that airs monthly. It was produced by Tor Evanstead. You can hear more from the project at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcast, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. A huge thank you to Ivy Engel, today's audio producer and digital and social media producer. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.